Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What shape does identity take when we never quite fit into our surroundings? My guest, Asif Mandvi, was born in Mumbai, spent most of his childhood in northern England, where his parents owned a small shop, and then at 16 moved with his family to Tampa, Florida. He was raised in a Muslim home, but dutifully sang Protestant hymns in his British boarding school, and as a newly arrived teenager in the U.S. in the mid-80s, found his impersonation of the moonwalking and crotch-grabbing Michael Jackson was his ticket to peer acceptance. Perhaps not surprisingly, this boy, who learned to survive by carefully observing and imitating others, discovered he had a gift for acting. As a man, Mandvi has had roles in everything from Miami Vice to ER to the last film directed by Ismail Merchant. These days, he is best known as a correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, where he was hired in 2006, and he's just published a book of personal essays called No Land's Man. Asif Mandvi, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Your parents immigrated not once, but twice in an effort to find a better life. That, to me, takes an extraordinary kind of spirit. Were your parents very optimistic people?
Or incredibly naive. I don't know.
Maybe it takes a little of both.
I never thought about it much as a kid. Now, looking back on it, I realize what a brave and somewhat irresponsible thing to do it was to do. Like, they basically, when I was 16 years old, my father decided we were going to leave the north of England and we were going to move to America. And he had wanted to move to America for a number of years. And it was the 80s, Thatcher, England's economy was sort of in the toilet. And, he had a friend, an old college roommate who lived in Tampa, Florida. And so we packed up and sold every last thing that we owned and moved to Tampa, Florida, which was we had sort of adapted to the life of immigrants in England, and now we were going to start all over again and adapt to a life as immigrants in America, which was a very different thing, you know? And the north of England versus Florida are incredibly different places.
Yeah, that's quite a culture shock. I mean, the language is the one common thing, but of course nobody sounds the same.
No. I remember coming, sort of being thrown into the midst of this American high school. I had come from a very sort of strict British boarding school where I had, spent the few years before that. And then I came to America and suddenly I was in this all-American high school, in Florida, where people were sort of, wearing shorts and riding around on skateboards, and there were girls everywhere. It was kind of a total immersion into Americana in a way. And I remember the first conversation I had with a kid, like on my second or third day in school, and he was talking to me and he said, I'm going to take off. And I literally thought he was going to like leave the earth, I didn't understand what he meant. It was literally, divided by a common language. I was sort of like, I was this little English kid, and I was like, I'm sorry, you're going to do what? You take off? And he's like, yeah, I'm going to take off, And I was like, all right, I'd love to see that, And so, it was an interesting experience. I always felt like in England growing up as a kid, when you're an immigrant, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, where if you're an immigrant in England, you never really feel like you are British. You always feel like you will be a foreigner no matter how long you live in England. The British are generally, I think, mistrusting of foreigners.
There's a certain irony to that.
Yeah. I think they have had to defend that tiny island from invasion for thousands of years. So maybe it's in the DNA somewhere. Hmm. Whereas America, which is a land of immigrants, there's an openness and sort of embracing of immigrants, and yet the opposite is true, which is there's a kind of like really a lack of curiosity about other cultures and other places and where you come from. You sort of, when you come to America, you're expected to just sort of fit in and become American, and now it's like pledge allegiance to the flag and you are now part of the American tapestry. You know, I have a line where I say Americans think about the rest of the world the way that New Yorkers think about the rest of America, which is they don't, you know.
Well, I think the children of immigrants are fascinating because you end up living this dual existence, right? I mean, what makes sense at home doesn't always fly at school or on the street and vice versa. And it seems like maybe you had just gotten that down in England and then you're in Florida.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I was 16 years old. I was adapting to sort of, you know, teenage years in England and then thrust into this other complete life. But it sort of made me, you know, probably contributed to what I brought as an actor to my work, you know, which is this sense of outsiderness that has always existed in my work and even in my work on The Daily Show and, you know, in all of the writing that I've done. It's always about sort of the voice of the person who is the outsider and the insider at the same time. And so it definitely, I think, contributed to my worldview, you know.
When you're doing those pieces on The Daily Show where you're interviewing someone that you were basically just going to send up the flagpole, and you know, as my producer was saying before the show, Stephen Becker, you guys just give people enough rope to hang themselves, but it does happen. I mean, as a classically trained actor, I would imagine that you are taught to be exquisitely tuned into the responses of the other person. And in those interviews, do you have to turn that off so that you can keep going through what turns out to be a really uncomfortable exchange?
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you what was the – all of my classical theater training and my acting school and all that stuff was not the thing that prepared me for The Daily Show. And honestly, the work that we do on The Daily Show – there's very little you can prepare for that in terms of like study or whatever. You know, like Samantha Bee said to me, I think my first week at The Daily Show, she said, no one can ever teach you how to do this job. The only thing that will teach you how to do it is by doing it. So you have to fail for a while and then eventually you'll just get better at it. But I did have years of a few years of street theater, improv, comedy training when I was just out of college and I worked at the Disney MGM Studios down in Orlando. And I was doing a lot of street theater. And street theater, you know, you go up to people and you kind of just, you know, screw around with them. You just like you sort of project scenarios onto them and get a reaction and go. And so that actually was much more similar to what I ended up doing on The Daily Show, which is that you end up playing a character and within the lens through the lens of that character, you walk into this interview. And sometimes it is uncomfortable and you have to sit in that uncomfortableness, which, you know, for me, the way I dealt with it was just inhabiting this character. I still see the person that I play on The Daily Show as a character that I play whose name happens to be the same as mine. But he has a lot of really smart Ivy League educated writers that work for him, you know?
Early in your career, you often had to like make this hard call with regard to how much to exploit your looks and your culture and what people assumed that said about you in order to play to stereotypes or against them. Can you explain what you call, is it petunking? Is that how you pronounce it?
Petunking. So in the late 90s or mid 90s when I first was going out on auditions a lot in New York and when I first got to New York in the early 90s, there was, you know, you'd go in for these roles and my friend Sakina Jaffrey, who is a terrific actress, and she, we sort of came up together in New York and I remember she coined this phrase actually and it was petanking, which means it's the sound that is made of an Indian accent as it is heard to the Western ear. So it sort of is like patang, 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 you know? And so we would have this, every time we go for auditions and we would talk about it, we would always say to each other, did they make you patank, you know, which meant did they make you do the head wobble? Did they make you do the accent? Did they ask you? And what it really was that it was a sound that represented a sort of caricature of being South Asian, devoid of any humanity or complexity or nuance. It was just for laughs, for the Western ear. And so we would go. I would go in for auditions like that all the time, and I talk about it in the book that one of my first auditions in when I got to New York was for a snake charmer in some commercial, and I went in and they asked me to do the head wobble and the accent, and then said to me, you know, do you – here's a crazy question, but do you actually know how to snake charm? and I was so desperate for the job that I actually said, well, I don't, but, you know, I am Indian, so it's in my DNA somewhere. I'm sure I can figure it out.
Wow. As you were saying that, like, was part of you just dying inside?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I do talk about the experience of sort of coming from kind of, you know, before that I had never, when I was in Florida in school and, you know, doing street theater and stuff, it was I was playing all kinds of different characters. And then when I got into the professional world of acting in New York, I found that most of the roles I went out for were these sort of stereotypical Indian kind of, you know, roles. And I found that, like, I actually realized, and it was a commentary on my own relationship to my own ethnicity, which was that I didn't know how to do an Indian accent. Hmm. I had grown up with it. I had heard my parents do it, but I had somewhere suppressed it so that, like, so when I first started going out for these auditions and they would ask me to do the Indian accent, I would attempt to do it and I would end up sort of sounding like a really effeminate Arab or, you know. or some kind of Russian or something, you know, and it was like, and then they would be like, that was terrific. And then I would have contempt for them because I'd be like, that was a terrible Indian accent because I knew what it was supposed to sound like.
Yeah.
It's just that my mouth did not make the right sounds, you know. And after a while, I figured that out. And actually, listen, it was very lucrative for me to sort of do the accent for a while and do these roles. But there was a part of me that often had to battle against, you know, there were many roles where you would get the audition and it was something that I think my Caucasian counterparts didn't have to deal with, which is that, like, there was this kind of sense of, like, here's a great role, but can I bring myself to actually do it? And do I feel, you know, somehow embarrassed or humiliated or, you know, are my parents going to watch this and feel like I'm an embarrassment, you know, by doing this kind of caricature or cartoon character or sometimes offensive roles that were just, you know, just racist. And so that was an element that I felt like was a struggle that South Asian actors dealt with a lot and probably and continue to deal with on some level. But something that my Caucasian counterparts never thought about, you know.
Do you remember the first, like, serious role that you got that wasn't because somebody thought, we need a good actor in here who has brown skin?
The role that I got that wasn't, you mean that didn't ask
that wasn't
me to do
based
that thing?
On, yeah, exactly.
Well, I got, you know, I got a role in a movie called Analyze This that Harold Ramis directed, and it was the character's name was Dr. Shulman, and he cast me in this role, and I remember saying to him, you know, are you sure you don't want to change the name to Dr. Patel or something, you know? And he was like, no, it's fine. Dr. Shulman, it's fine. It's totally fine. You know, and I ended up doing this role. And it was the first time that I got to play something that wasn't a stereotype or, you know. But it was interesting because I think what happens often is that on one hand, there's a kind of, you know, orientalization of the stereotype where you end up playing this kind of patanking role, right? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you end up playing this role that is essentially a white guy, but they just decide to put a brown person in there. So you're not actually playing an authentic brown person. You're actually just playing a white character who, you know, and then there were many occasions where they didn't even change the name. And so I think it's sort of our relationship to race is very interesting that way because...
Let me jump in. Sorry, we have to take a really quick break here. We'll pick this up in a moment. My guest is Asif Manvi. His new book is called No Land's Man, back in 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
I mean, sure, some of us work in convenience stores selling you the crap that gives you diabetes, but guess what? The rest of us, including the new Miss America, are in medical school cashing in on that illness. Double cha-ching! You got what we like to say, you got Gupta. You had a good run. You took this country away from the Indians, and now a different group of Indians is taking it back.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. You just heard my guest, Asif Manvi, on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. After Miss New York, an Indian American named Nina Davuluri was crowned Miss America last September and met with racist backlash. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But right now, I want you, Asif, if you would, to go back to this idea that you were discussing before. There is the Indian, because we absolutely need an ethnic Indian in this role. And then there is the idea of, well, we could have anybody in here, so let's go ahead and get someone in who's brown, but have them play what was essentially written for a white character.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of times that I auditioned for roles that, you know, it's sort of like they're just looking for any ethnicity, right? So they just write this character that is white, essentially, and then they have me, you know, an African-American, a fat Jewish guy, you know, and a dwarf. You know what I mean? We all kind of come in for the same role because all of those things are essentially the same. If you're not Caucasian, then you're just this other thing, right? Yeah. So,
and meanwhile, the Caucasians are like patting themselves on the back for considering you. I would imagine.
Right, exactly. You know, and that's the thing. It's like everything is based – the baseline is always Caucasian. So it's always like Caucasian is the normal, you know, and then everything else isn't adjunct to that or, you know. So that was – a lot of the experience was that, like, you'd end up playing these roles that were either like, you know, where they petank you and then – or they would ask you – you were not brown. You were just – you know, and it was very difficult sometimes because they would – you know, write a character and then not change any of the vernacular, not change any of the names or anything or the sense of the character and just be like, okay, I have a brown guy. And it sort of feels like, you know, a lot of times people will argue, well, that's a good thing. You know, that's great, isn't it? Like, that's progress. And it is in a way. But for me, real progress is when the character can actually exist as a brown person and still be part of the American experience and American tapestry and sort of not – and be recognized for their difference and their immigrant, you know, you can be a character named Raj and still be an American kind of thing. You know, you don't have to be Bob, you know.
So would say the character of Dr. Shulman have been different if he had been Dr. Patel?
It wouldn't have been I wouldn't have played it any differently. That was a case where, you know, I probably wouldn't have done anything different with it. But I think in terms of just what it told me in that moment was that, like, it didn't matter that, you know, it was great for me in some ways, but also on a larger cultural context, I felt like it didn't matter. Like, it wasn't. There were situations, for example, where I played a character named Bob Spalding in a movie called The Proposal, and the character's name was Bob Spalding, and I thought, well, how do I justify being called Bob Spalding, you know, because clearly I would never be called Bob Spalding. So I think I came up with this idea that my real name was Babu Subramanian and I had just decided to call myself Bob Spalding so that people could pronounce my name. And that was the way I sort of, you know, in my own actor head kind of got around that conundrum, you know. But you know, that happens all the time. And like I said, I think, you know, it's two sides of a sort of inability to really contextualize or integrate with racial differences and racial identity, you know?
I was really interested. It's a small thing that you wrote about, but when you got to your high school in Florida, people would sort of, thinking that they were doing your name right, they would kind of overcorrect it and they would call you like Asif. Is that right?
Yeah. So, like, I, you know, for a long time was called Asif. And my name is pronounced Asif, right? And that is the correct pronunciation of the name. And I would never correct them. So that it wasn't their fault. They would call me Asif because that's how they saw it or heard it. And then it wasn't until like they heard my mother call me Asif or something. And then they would be like, wait, is your name Asif or Asif? And I remember being confused by that question because I was like, oh, I guess I think for a long time I didn't even realize there was a difference, because when you live in a world that is kind of split, when you live in a kind of fractured existence of like your family behaves one way and the outside world behaves another way, and the two things are separate in your mind, I realized like, oh, for me, it wasn't a conundrum that my parents called me Asif and my friends called me Asif. But for my friends, especially my Caucasian friends, it was a conundrum. Like they were like, wait, what is your name? You know, which name is it that we call you? And I realized that is part of the identity split that happens when you are an immigrant, which is that you are so used to compartmentalizing yourself into different places and into different arenas to fit in to different modes and different groups that you could actually have a different name and not realize it.
I think there's something really amazing about the ability to do that kind of code shifting. It just seems like you shouldn't always have to.
No. And, you know, yes, I agree. You shouldn't always have to. And I don't know any other way of being. So, you know, it probably, you know, I don't know if the chicken or the egg came first, but it probably contributed to my kind of being an actor and being I don't know if I became better at that because I was already had a proclivity to being an actor and a shapeshifter in some ways, or that came because of I had to adapt to my environment. So, you know, that's been the sort of, I think, story of my life, which is adapting to different environments that I'm not necessarily from, you know, and being thrust into those environments and figuring out where I exist. And it wasn't until many years, it took me many years to discover that actually my difference and my outsiderness was actually my source of strength in those dynamics, you know? Because I think also as an immigrant kid, you living in a world that is favors, you know, and I grew up in England, so of course it favors Caucasian men. Mm-hmm. You know, you realize that like you're always kind of trying to fit into a group that is in some way, you're always trying to get into a party that you're not invited to, really, you know? And so the idea of ultimately realizing that like, oh, I actually, my outsiderness is my source of strength, and that is the only place I can go to get that strength, you know? And that brings us to a larger question of what it does it mean to be a South Asian man in the West, as an immigrant, you know, and who your role models are and stuff like that.
When you were a kid, your role model was Henry Winkler, and your mom said, "How about Omar Sharif?"
Right. Well, that's a perfect example of that. You know, where I was as a kid watching Happy Days on television because American pop culture was what I grew up on. You know, and so I'm watching Happy Days and seeing the Fonz, and I remember thinking like, this guy has a really crazy last name because his real name was Fonzarelli, right? So he's like got this uncool Arthur Fonzarelli name, like me, like my real name was Asif Manviwala. And so I was like, he's got a really uncool name and he's the Fonz. So maybe I can become the Mons, you know? And so I really thought like that's what I wanted to be, you know? And I wanted to be this leather jacket wearing, motorcycle riding, James Dean type character, which is the sort of the American image of masculinity, you know? And then on the other hand, I told my mother, oh, I want to be the Fonz. I want to be. And she said, what about Omar Sharif? And it was mind blowing for me because initially I was like, what? No, not Omar Sharif, the Fonz. And and in that story that I tell in my book about that sort of dilemma I had between am I the Fonz? I want to be like the Fonz, or do I want to be like this guy, Omar Sharif? Is sort of, you know, is a microcosm of the whole thing, right? Which is basically that, like, after seeing Omar Sharif and realizing who he was, I realized, oh, this is another version of masculinity that I have not been exposed to, which is that here's this brown man in a white world, and he was the first sort of brown movie star that I remember seeing, and he was not in a Bollywood movie. He was in like a Western movie, and he was not playing a slave or a servant or, he wasn't in a Tarzan movie. It was like he was this gentleman, and it was really inspiring for me because I looked at him and said, oh, he can exist. That exists. And so therefore, maybe I can also exist in that way, in the culture. Because up until then, my only role model was the Fonz, And that, I think, is a microcosm of that dilemma of the immigrant mindset,
Your experiences in your British boarding school seemed just so brutal. Like, I got new perspective on Lord of the Flies and how Golden could have written that book. I mean, do you have the sense today as an adult, and I realize, you grew up at a time before everybody was sort of protecting kids in quite the same way they do, but do you think the adults knew what was going on and chose to turn a blind eye?
Yes, I think they did know what was going on. And I think England is a place of tradition and culture, and these boarding schools, these private boarding schools, they have long history, and often the teachers that taught there were often ex-students that had even gone to that school. So, there was a kind of history of this sort of hazing, bullying and abuse and violent abuse amongst from older children to younger children, when I look back on it now, I realize like I was 13 years old when I went to British boarding school, and the kids that were abusing me were 16 and 15, 16, 17, so they weren't exactly, their brains hadn't really developed that much either, So it was an interesting world, a sort of a Lord of the Flies exactly kind of world where you had these rules that were created and this kind of level of abuse and then these people who come out of these schools are often the leaders of industry and government. So,
Were you tempted to you name a few names here. I don't know if you gave people pseudonyms or what, but were you tempted to write these people's names down and leave a record of what they did to you? We should say that they hazed you. They made you sit outside on a ledge outside a closed window in winter, and you were afraid you were going to die.
Yeah, well, there's a story in the book called The Ledge, which is a story of me, of one particular incident where I was put out on a ledge in the middle of winter. And obviously I've changed all the names and I have taken some creative license in that story of what happened. But the essence of it is that I was out on this ledge in the middle of winter. And that was actually one of the more tame abuses that I, that wasn't at least a physical violence thing. There were other things that were much more physical and, dealing with like physical abuse and sort of repressed sexuality of like, kids, you're also in a very burgeoning place, 13 years old, where you're emerging, you're trying to figure out yourself sexually and stuff and who you are. And there was a lot of abuse around that. So it was a place, for me, it was not a, now I look back on it and it's funny because I'm actually friends with some of those guys who I went to boarding school with on Facebook and stuff, and it's like, everything comes out in the wash in the end. But it's like the stuff that I went through at that time, I think it definitely informed my relationship to the culture at large and all that stuff. And it was soon after that we moved to America as well. So I kind of got out of England and that school. But, it was a dark period,
I love that you say that when you got to Florida, your school felt like vacation to you because I guess the standards weren't as high.
Right. It did. It felt like, the one thing, look, my parents, as good immigrant parents are wont to be, they sent me in that boarding school that I went to. It was one of the most highly accredited academic institutions in the north of England. Like it was a very good school and continues to be a really good school. when I came to America, I felt like I was sort of, you know, in this vacation land where, you know, I remember, back in England, it was sort of reading, writing and arithmetic, you know, and Latin and all this stuff. And here we were taking classes like, you know, psychology and things, you know, very sort of American kind of, you know, take on education, you know. And there was this kind of weird sort of familiarity between teachers and students, like people would joke around. And I just thought, like, this is like crazy, like. Teachers are making jokes with students and, you know, and there was laughter and, you know. But again, like I say, there was on the surface, there was that. But then the underside of that was that there was actually very little curiosity about who I actually was in this world. And America was kind of a place where you were either black or you were either white. Hmm. And if you were anything in between, people didn't quite know what to make of you, you know.
But you mentioned like finding the one other Indian kid, like I guess in your school or in your grade,
yeah.
Who socially was in a different stratosphere from you. But you thought, well, maybe we'll have this in common.
Well, that's what I thought. You know, I thought, oh, I'll make friends with this one other Indian kid and he will. And then, you know, it just felt familiar to me in some way. And then I realized like, oh, he's all American. Actually, he was on the baseball team and in the band and, you know, and I was like mostly British. So other than the fact that we were Indian and our parents – or not even Indian. Other than the fact that our parents both came from India, we had nothing in common. And he quickly saw me as a social liability and got rid of me. And then what happened to me throughout – in trying to find, my cafeteria – friends,
your tribe.
I ended up hanging out with the actors and found drama, and those became sort of my group of people that I hung out with in high school.
Actor and writer Asif Manvi is my guest. He's a correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and he has a new book of personal essays out called No Land's Man. We will return to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Looks as though Mother Russia is in complete control of this competition, but don't count out America's homophobia. Team USA has been regressing all winter, and I think we have a shot.
I got to tell you, Asif, in other years, I would say yes. Mm-hmm. But this year, with this level of competition, yeah. There's no way. The African countries, Russia is too strong.
Oh, ye of little bigotry. We have got a strong field. Young reality star Juan Pablo Galavis of The Bachelor.
There's this thing about gay people that it seems to me, you know, and I don't know if I'm mistaken or not. Well, I met great, you know, I have a lot of friends like that, but they're more pervert in a sense.
Oh, USA! USA! USA!
No, don't encourage. You stack that up against life imprisonment. I mean, I don't even see that guy making the finals.
Well, okay, to be fair, the glaring gaffe is not his event.
All right.
Check out his entry in the 100-meter backtrack.
Galavis released a statement on his Facebook page saying the word pervert was not what I meant to say. What I meant to say was that gay people are more affectionate and intense, and for a segment of this TV audience, this would be too racy to accept.
Is he saying two people of the same gender falling in love is too racy? Americans prefer seeing a dude with 20 different girls he just met in a hot tub to winnow them down to the one he will ultimately break up with via tabloid magazine?
Right! Traditional marriage!
All right.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. You just heard my guest, Asif Manvi, with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, speculating on which country in the 2014 Olympics was most homophobic. Asif, I have to ask you, when you do those, I mean, I realize that you tape ahead of time and then the show is probably edited up a little bit. How often do you have to break for laughter, or is everybody just so professional that that's not an issue anymore?
You know, when we do those live things in front of an audience, we don't stop that much. Actually, I don't mean to say that we're all so professional and we've got it all figured out, because, I mean, technical things happen. Things we do break sometimes, but for the most part, I feel like, you know, we're pretty. We go right through the show. Like, it's rarely do we stop for things. You know, it just. You know, again, for me, my attitude in those pieces that I do is always just the same thing I've done as a stage actor for years, which is, you know, you just focus on the character and just believe in the situation. So it's just basic acting stuff for me. I go out there and so I don't usually break, because. I think I'm just A, terrified sometimes, and B, just kind of in the character of what I'm saying, you know.
The way you use your voice in pieces like that is just so great. Like, it's almost like you could read the phone book and it would be funny. And of course, the content is very funny as well and very smart. But how did you learn that kind of, like, you don't always do it when you're on the show, but that sort of high shouting at, like, really enthusiastic delivery would work for the persona that you have on The Daily Show?
You know, here's the thing. I don't unpack that stuff for myself. Uh-huh. It's very, I guess I feel sort of like if I do, then it kind of, whatever it is I do on The Daily Show is organically what has developed over the course of the time that I've been on The Daily Show. You know, they always talk to us when we first got there, or not us, but me and all correspondents, we heard this, like, you know, find your character, and who your persona is on The Daily Show. And for me, it just happened very organically. I never expected to be on The Daily Show. I never felt like, when I first got there, I didn't really feel like I belonged on The Daily Show, and I was kind of trying to fit in and figure out what it was that I was doing, and I was just trying to, like, play the jokes. I was just trying to hit the jokes and just make sure that I didn't screw up the laughs, you know? And out of that just came the persona that has developed, and it's very organic for me. I don't really, you know, people always talk to me about the fact that, like, they love my delivery on the show, or sometimes they don't. You know, I have Twitter followers who are like, please stop shouting at me, you know? But then other people, thank God, like what I'm doing. So it's – but I can't unpack it. I get very I let the alchemy of whatever it is just be what it is, you know?
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. And we have – looks like a Tim or a team. Don't want to overpronounce. In Frisco, hi.
Hi. It's Atim, actually.
Atim, hi. Welcome.
Wonderful guest, fascinating. I've never actually heard of him, but I've been glued
never
to my radio
what?
Listening to his story, because his life story sounds pretty much the same as mine. I was attended boarding school in England, actually in Scotland, then came over to America, and I guess my number one problem was the name issue. I'm always having people ask me, is it Autumn? A team or a team, and it got to the point sometimes where I felt like I should change my name and make it more anglicized. So, as my question to your guest is, has he ever been tempted to change his name?
Well, you know, I did shorten my name. My last name is Manviwala, and I, for professional reasons, just shortened it to Manvi. But I never – my first name, Asif, has always – you know, I never thought about changing it, really. I think, you know, I guess I just thought, well, some people are going to get it wrong. And I think – and then it's just a question of it just becomes a conversation about the name, which, you know, maybe is a good thing in some ways. It helps people remember. I don't know. I'm not a big proponent of you changing your name. So I would say people will figure out how to say it. You know, they will. I mean, people usually want to say your name correctly. It's somehow it's almost like the syntax or something in the brain doesn't work, and they can't. People will often say to me, for example, "Oh, Asif," and then 5 minutes later they're calling me Akbar. You know what I mean? And it's like they want to say it right. They're very well intentioned, but somehow it takes them a little longer. You know.
You write really sensitively here. I mean, there's a lot of humor in the book about your parents, but you write really sensitively about them and about the things that were hard for them, not least of which was the fact that your dad's career never quite turned out the way it was, and he mm-hmm. would, you know, be very angry. And I wonder if it sort of took you a while as an adult to see him in a 360-degree view as opposed to this guy who sometimes, you know, wanted to do things differently than you wanted to do them.
Yeah. I mean, I think it took me becoming an adult and sort of going out into the world and sort of reflecting back on it. And I think part of that's kind of what I've done in my writing, even when I wrote my one-man play, Sakina's Restaurant, and in the book, this current book, that, you know, like where I've sort of taken my parents and kind of, you know, the thing I wanted, I've used my parents as a source of my writing and creative stuff for years, and but what I've always tried to do is sort of try to write about them and give them perhaps a point of view or a voice that maybe they didn't have themselves because of their inability to communicate what it is they were, what was going on with them, you know, and through the benefit of better education and an understanding of the culture, I am able to like go back and sort of paint them in a way that gives them more nuance and understanding in, you know, which I didn't have of them when I was young, you know. So yeah, I think, you know, that is the benefit of maturity, I guess, is being able to like sort of it sounds cliched, but being able to understand your parents in a way that you didn't.
Does your dad love everything you do, or does he also feel free to like give you tips and pointers on how you could have done like an acting job better?
Well, you know, it's funny because when you're an actor and the first time you are successful at all or do anything on television or on stage, whatever, your parents come and see it and they just, you know, like, you were great. At least my parents were like, you were great, you know. And then as it becomes more sort of routine for them, they start to then feel like they can give you credit. So, you know, it was funny because when I first was on The Daily Show, it was just like, everything, great. Yeah. And then I remember one day, like, I was on The Daily Show and I asked my dad, you know, like, what do you think? And he was like, who picks out your ties? And I was like, what? And he's like, no, your tie. I mean, you were good, but your tie, I don't know. Why did you pick that tie? Who picks the ties? And I'm like, who picks the ties? And he was literally like, I think maybe a different tie next time. You know, the tie didn't really go. And it was literally one of those things where I was like, he was trying to, in some way, you know, give me feedback in a way that felt sort of like he was part of it. And, you know, but clearly, like, the only thing he had a comment on was the tie, you know. So and I remember having this reaction of like, don't tell me about look, I'm fine with the ties. OK, like, just don't worry about the ties. You know, I'm just telling you, that's my initial reaction, you know. So you find that your parents start to get into that place of like wanting to be part of it and then wanting to like give you criticism, but they really don't know what criticism to give you sometimes. And so they just end up, you know, criticizing your wardrobe.
You also tell a great story about your dad, the fact that you'd never been prouder of him than the day he got fired from his last mm-hmm. job.
Yes. So he got my dad was working as a customer service rep later in life. He was working for Verizon Customer Service and got fired for using profanity. And I took that incident, which happened, and sort of created a story because I wasn't there when it actually happened, obviously. But we all knew about it, and he told the story. But I sort of tried to create, again, a scenario of what that might have been like, you know, for him in that moment of dealing with this belligerent and racist sort of person on the other end of the line who was basically saying, "I don't understand what you're saying. I can't understand your accent," and all this stuff. And for me, that story became really about this – a couple of things. Where it was really – it became about like sort of the void, the space between how we don't listen to each other, you know, how we don't really I tried not to turn the other character on the other into a complete villain, and I tried to give him a humanity as well and a frustration that he was dealing with in terms of talking to a nameless, faceless customer service rep who he couldn't understand. But like how that, you know, in some small way is the same thing that happens on a larger level in the world, which is that we just don't listen to each other. We're speaking two different languages literally, and we just can't understand each other's vernacular. And then also like this world that we live in now where the anonymity of our interaction with other people on Twitter, on Facebook, on, you know, allows us to throw civility out of the window and kind of say cruel, mean, nasty things to people because we're not in front of them, because we don't, you know. And so there's a level of that that's going on in this story as well, where these two men have this anonymity, you know, because I sort of, as much as I, the character on the other end of the line is someone who is throwing out racial stuff, and I tried not to turn him into a complete villain. And I also gave my dad an edge in that story where I thought maybe he at one point could have transferred the call to another person, but he chose not to because he was angry that this person was you know, not dealing with him. And so he was like forcing him to deal with him, you know. And so that tension was what I was trying to explore in that story.
And it is a narrative that we kind of ignore, that sometimes the person who has been really abused has to turn around and stand up for themselves. And that's not really right. The way we tell that story in America.
No. And, you know, this is kind of, again, in many of these stories, and not to blow it out of proportion, but I've tried to resonate things on a slightly larger level than just the story itself. And it does sort of feel to me like on a global level that is kind of, you know, there are situations in the world where, you have, for example, today in the Middle East, like, you know, the Muslim world is dealing with a history of colonialism and imperialism and all this stuff. And there's this kind of recent thing of like the Muslim world's reaction to that then becomes demonized, mm-hmm. you know? So it's like, oh, the contextual history of like hundreds of years of Western foreign policy creates a situation that then becomes demonized in the West. And so, you know what I mean? And that was sort of the microcosm of what this story was also for me in some ways.
Actor and writer Asif Manvi is a correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and author of a new book of essays called No Land's Man. Asif, it's been a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much. It was great.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.